Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The Federal Reserve is a bank that has greatly expanded its stake in the financial sector over the past couple of years. So what does a bank with a huge balance sheet need? Why, traders to manage it, of course. The Help Wanted sign is out at the Fed. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
American Public Media presents After the Bell, a weekly podcast that makes sense of the week in business and the economy, available at marketplace.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, today the 11th of August. Good to have you with us. First, to the nitty-gritty of the Federal Reserve meeting that started today. Mr. Bernanke and his colleagues on the Open Market Committee will announce their decision on interest rates tomorrow afternoon. Everybody who is anybody in the macroeconomic world is betting there won't be any change. But as we mentioned yesterday, there's more the Fed can and is doing to beat back the recession. For instance, the central bank has bought roughly $500 billion worth of mortgage-backed securities in just the past 6 months. Today, the corollary to that decision turns out when you absorb all those investments, you need a lot more people to handle them. Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
Wall Street has shed thousands of jobs in the last few years, but one employer is hiring: traders, risk managers, and analysts. The Federal Reserve Bank of New York says by the end of this year, its markets group will have added around 160 people since 2007.
They've just had to expand massively the range of things that they're staying on top of.
Anil Kashyap sits on the New York Fed's Economic Advisory Panel. He visited the bank's ninth floor recently and found it buzzing like any Wall Street trading floor, with one important difference. Wall Street recruiter Richard Lipstein guesses a Fed trader might make $100,000 to $150,000 a year, a far cry from the millions the top earners can make on Wall Street. But he says there are other reasons to sign up with the Fed.
Wall Street eats its young, and I think people reach a point in their lives where they'll give up certain benefits, a certain amount of money, in order to have a better lifestyle.
Some have criticized the New York Fed for being too cozy with Wall Street, but Kashyap says the bank needs experienced people.
If you're going to rule out anybody that's worked at large financial institutions in the last 10 years, you're going to end up with a government that's full of much less qualified people than I think we would want.
Kashyap says the people the Fed does want aren't likely the ones responsible for the financial mess. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Speaking of the financial mess, if TARP hasn't already become a part of your daily vocabulary, here's a refresher. It's the Troubled Asset Relief Program, last fall's $700 billion bailout to help stabilize the financial system. Today, the congressional panel that's supposed to monitor that program gave us an update, and the headline goes like this: the financial system may not be out of the woods just yet, and it's the small banks that you got to watch. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports.
The report says smaller banks are more likely to be hurt by troubles in the commercial real estate market. Loan defaults are rising as layoffs and weak consumer spending empty office buildings and malls. Harvard professor Elizabeth Warren chairs the TARP oversight panel. She says if there's a bust in commercial real estate, it's still to come because many mortgage rates haven't reset yet.
That is, the mortgages that were put out in 2006, 2007, even into 2008, don't come due until 2012, 2013, 2014, and that's when the numbers really start to get big.
The panel recommends more stress tests for the 19 largest banks that were already tested, but especially for the smaller ones that weren't.
They are the principal lenders to small businesses, and so when small banks go down, it means that our capacity to get more money into the hands of small businesses shrinks.
Bruce McCain is chief investment strategist for Key Private Bank. He says the panel's report is a good list of things to worry about if the economy heads back downhill.
But for the moment, things seem to be trending in a good direction, and we'll hope that their dire warnings about what could happen simply will not happen.
Furthermore, McCain says small and regional banks don't pose nearly the same threat to the overall economy as the 19 largest banks. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
President Obama went to New Hampshire today. He was there for a town hall meeting on his health care overhaul. Over on this side of the country, at an old basketball arena here in Los Angeles, there was a meeting of people without health insurance. Some of them waited in line overnight to make sure they got in to see a doctor from the Remote Area Medical Volunteer Corps. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports.
The sun is barely up at the Forum Arena. In the parking lot, people are sprawled on picnic blankets, napping in pitched tents and standing in clusters. Tamika Scott holds an orange ticket in her hands and watches the gate. Well, what time did you get here?
2:19 a.m. And then we came out and walked up and got our tickets.
And what are your numbers?
345. They're giving out no more than 1,500 numbers, and they had reached that goal by 5 a.m.
More than 45 million Americans don't have health insurance, and the problem is especially serious among younger people, like 24-year-old Sasaya Rojo and her 19-year-old sister Adriana, who cracked her tooth a month ago.
The pain was unbearable. I haven't been sleeping. I haven't been eating.
The sisters say they're both students and can't afford health insurance. They hold their tickets, number 275 and 276, as a man with a bullhorn appears at the entrance to the arena.
275. 276. 276. I don't know where to go. I'm so excited. I can't run because my cheek hurts.
Who's ever been this excited about a dentist before?
Not me.
Remote Area Medical was started to bring doctors to the Amazon, but the group now does much of its work in the U.S., Doctors and nurses from all over the country are here volunteering for the next week, like retired nurse Jo Lane.
Mainly people haven't had health care. There's been hypertension is a big one, and some diabetes. People need health care. So to me, it's an honor to be able to be part of RAM.
Lane says most of the people here also need dental care, and that isn't even part of the health reform debate in Washington. But it's the priority for Adriana and Sasaya Rojo. They take another number and walk down near the old basketball court. Beds are lined up in rows with doctors rushing in every direction.
I won't get sick anymore, I promise.
Again, win the lottery or something.
Their wait to see a dentist, about 2.5 hours. In Inglewood, California, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, it was bad, then it got better, then it got worse. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton was in the Democratic Republic of Congo yesterday and this morning. She spent some time at a refugee camp in Goma, where she said more has to be done to protect civilians from the violence that's happening there. She also promised economic help. Congo is one of the world's richest countries, if you measure by natural resources. Yet for all the abundance, it's plagued by war, by poverty, and public corruption. The secretary is promising the U.S. will send a team of experts to help improve economic and financial management. Marketplace's Dan Gretsch reports.
Precious metals practically burst through the soil in the Congo. Diamonds and gold, bauxite and zinc, copper and cobalt, and 80% of the world's coltan, which is used in laptops and cell phones.
The country has just got this superabundance of natural resources, and yet the people are among the poorest in the world.
That's Dave Peterson, head of the Africa program at the National Endowment for Democracy. The team of legal and financial experts Secretary Clinton has promised will work with the government to root out corruption and improve fiscal management. John Prendergast is co-founder of the Enough Project at the Center for American Progress.
The commitment that the United States would like to make is to help the Congolese authorities get some control over the extraordinary riches and wealth that continues to evaporate or evade the state treasury.
Experts say for Secretary Clinton's plan to work, it will need buy-in from the Congo's government and some solution to Congo's bloody war with rebels in the east. Osita Afoaku is a professor of public policy at Indiana University, Bloomington.
You have to end the war because political and military leaders use the war as a pretext for stealing resources that belong to the public.
Clinton said the U.S. was committed to military cooperation and to bringing Congo's war to an end. She offered millions of dollars to help prevent rape, a common crime in the fighting, and to professionalize Congo's army. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
The automotive news of the day is electric in more ways than one. General Motors announced today its new electric car, the Chevy Volt, will get 230 miles to the gallon when it hits the market next year. If it's going to survive until the middle of 2010, though, the post-bankruptcy GM is going to have to sell some other cars as well, the first one of which is just out.
It's a Buick LaCrosse. Yes, the 2010, probably the only one in California, so this is big.
Los Angeles Times car critic Dan Neal joined us last week at the Marketplace Test Track, otherwise known as the Parking Garage here at 261 South Figueroa Street. The Buick is not a bad-looking car, but I was a little surprised to hear that the first product launch of the new GM is a brand that's been around for more than 100 years.
Understand that this is kind of a legacy car. This is a project that began in the old GM. And now, because of the way the timing has worked out, it is the first car of the new GM.
How long has this car been in the works?
About 36 months. And it was developed between China and the U.S. People have asked, well, why didn't they keep Saturn? Because Saturn had the fresher product mix, had the better fuel economy. Because Buick is huge in China, and so they were looking at the global market potential.
Right. I'm obliged to point out that I think the average age of the Buick consumer is like 70-something.
It's dead, yeah. Generally, so, these things come with dialysis machines.
It's not bad-looking. Beefier-looking than I would have thought.
Yes, exactly. More masculine, more planted, lower to the ground.
The doors are big.
Yes,
doors are huge.
Yes, indeed.
All right, time to take your first spin.
Okay.
All right, so here we are pulling out onto 2nd Street. Of course, there's construction here. We're going to go through the tunnel as we always do.
Yep.
Where is this car going to fall in the consumer mindset? Are people going to look at this and say, ooh, sporty little thing, or mid-class sedan? What's it going to be?
Well, what we've got here is a slightly bigger, slightly heavier version of a Lexus ES350. In every respect I can tell, it's the equal or better of the Lexus. Now, the question is, what does the brand mean?
Yeah.
And this is the big problem, because the Buick brand has got to dig itself out of this tremendous deficit because of the recent history. And the long-term history being known as the, you know, the doctor's car going back decades. Can it win over younger buyers? Well, I think it can, but they've got a lot of communications work.
All right, let me try a slightly tortured analogy here. You know how movies these days are made like on opening night when people Twitter what they thought about it and tell their friends on Facebook, and it's either sink or swim within the first 3 hours of the thing being on the screen. When this car comes out, how much time does GM have to make it a hit?
30 days. Hmm. 30 days. I think this is really... box office for this car is crucial. They've got to get people in the showrooms. They've got to have people raving about the car. They've got to be able to, you know, change people's attitudes.
Where does GM go if this car doesn't work?
Well, you know, fortunately for GM, they have been able to strip down to, you know, a fighting weight so that they do have a future in the business for some time to come. You know, another way to look at it is that GM used to be the incumbent, the target for Toyota. Now GM is the upstart. They have the advantages. They are stripped down. They have lower production costs. They are hungrier. And that is an extraordinary possibility that GM might be the one to come out and kick butt.
Well, pull this number then out of wherever you car guys pull it, and tell me what GM is going to make on this car.
Per unit?
Yeah.
You know, I think probably $1,500, $2,000.
Is that pretty good?
No, not really. no, I think that they probably are cutting it pretty thin. And but that's what they ought to do, because for years they just raked obscene per unit profits out of trucks and SUVs, and they didn't put the money back in product development, which was a huge mistake. Really, that was the original sin.
I will tell you, it's kind of a nice ride. I mean, I enjoyed it. It feels good. It clearly handles city streets reasonably well, and it feels nice.
You know, I almost want to say, if you love your country and you need a Lexus, buy a Buick. And because I frankly want to get my money back.
Right.
So, Kai, the question is, what can I do to put you in a Buick today?
Oh, Dan Neely writes on cars for the Los Angeles Times, comes by every now and then and brings us something fun. Dan, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai.
Coming up, you're looking for work? Try North Dakota. Seriously.
We have thousands of jobs available in the state. As of July 1, there were about 9,000 openings.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials fell 96 points today, 1%, closed at 92.41. The NASDAQ slid 22 points, that is 1.1%, ended the day at 1969. The S&P 500 was down 12 points, 1.25%, finished at 994. Financials took a hit. Bank of America cashed out nearly 5%. J.P. Morgan Chase dropped more than 3%. Wells Fargo gave back 6%. CIT plunged nearly 19% today. The troubled lender delayed its quarterly report to the SEC. Bond insurer MBIA dropped 12.5%. Analysts say the mounting losses from bad mortgages and other credit will eventually overtake that company's capital, and that would be a very bad thing, believe me. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.67%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business. www.batteninstitute.org. Now you can take Marketplace with you wherever you go. Tap marketplace.org into your mobile phone for the latest business news, decoders that explain financial terms, and updates on the economic crisis.
Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on international trade for June. At the National Press Club, the Population Reference Bureau releases its 2009 data sheet. There are almost 7 billion people on the planet. And President Obama awards the Presidential Medal of Freedom to 16 men and women who have changed the world for the better, including Billie Jean King, Harvey Milk, and Sandra Day O'Connor. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal.
I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter.
The letters in our inbox came in several different flavors this week. Just as the news was full of cash for clunkers, so too did that topic generate a lot of mail. We had a couple of stories dissecting the now $3 billion program. Old gas guzzlers are broken down into scrap so they can't be resold. But Ron Walker from Torrance, California, cares less about getting the junk off the road and more about the jobs that will be saved, like his at Toyota.
Dealerships employ a ton of people here in the U.S., so if cash for clunkers keeps those dealers from laying off their employees for a couple more months, it's probably worth it.
Brian Ort in San Francisco heard our story on couples with dual incomes and no kids, or dinks as they're called, and how they are still spending despite the bad economy. He says just because a couple doesn't have children doesn't mean they're living the easy life, you know, like drinking margaritas in Mexico.
Right. And it doesn't mean that all we think about is, oh, where are we going to spend our next $100 or our next $10? Mostly, I think what we're trying to do is hold on to our money like everybody else.
Julia Jones in Orlando, Florida, wrote to comment on an interview we did. Last week, I spoke with behavioral economist Dan Ariely about a government proposal to create mandatory 401k plans. Jones says she's fine with another government program to stimulate savings. She just wishes she could change a different program, one that's been around for a while.
I know for a fact that I do not contribute enough to my 401k, and I would love to double my deposit every pay period. And, you know, I actually could if I weren't paying as much into Social Security, in fact, even a little bit more than I'm paying into my own 401k.
On now to subjects less financial and more fashionable. Clothing makers are mad about plaid this back-to-school season, and that annoyed Doug Phillips in Portland, Oregon.
I've got nothing against plaid. In fact, I'm wearing some plaid today, as a matter of fact.
So clearly, Mr. Phillips is down with plaid, but when some marketer tells him to wear it?
Companies, essentially, they try to come up with some kind of thing that's going to be the end thing for the year, And I understand, you know, these businesses need to make money and everything, but it seems to me like fashion should be more driven from what people really want rather than what designers or retailers decide what's going to be the end thing for the season.
If you think the things we're saying are in or are totally out of bounds, be sure to tell us. Go to our website. It's marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. There's pretty broad agreement. The July unemployment report we got last Friday was a good thing. The economy lost 247,000 jobs last month, a substantial improvement over earlier this year. But before we declare this recession over and done with, commentator Justin Wolfers says there is a bigger problem to be dealt with.
The latest employment report led many economists to predict that a recovery may be just around the corner. But beneath this good news lies a ticking time bomb. Long-term unemployment has risen sharply. And I worry that it's going to be tough to connect these folks with jobs, even when the economy recovers. The numbers are startling. Right now, more than half of the unemployed have been out of work for 3 months or more. That's not only a record, it's double the post-war average. More ominously, nearly 3 in 10 unemployed workers have been out of work for more than half a year. That's nearly 5 million people. With so many long-term jobless, this recession will be different. Why? Because countless studies document that the longer you're out of work, the harder it is to find. Prolonged joblessness leads people to lose hope and to lose heart. You spend less time with other workers and become less likely to hear about promising job leads. You risk slipping behind in the skills race as you get rusty, while others keep learning. And when the recovery begins, employers won't create new jobs if they can't find job-ready workers. Historically, American workers shrugged off the ill effects of recession pretty quickly, and so economic recoveries were usually rapid. It's been easy for US workers to be resilient when they've only been out of work for a month or two. Economists contrast this with Europe, where unemployment spells are measured in years rather than months. My fear is that this time, our unemployment problem looks European, and so I worry that our recovery may look European too, gradual and incomplete. Europeans know that a long-term unemployment problem can persist for many years, even after the recession ends. Avoiding a European-style unemployment problem requires aggressive policies to keep the unemployed connected to the world of work. Job training programs can help keep the unemployed job-ready, but the best training program is a real job. Our greatest economic risk is the risk of doing too little to get folks back to work.
Justin Wolfers is a professor of business and public policy at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. Take a moment to send us your thoughts. Write to us at marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. The July unemployment rate was 9.4%. That sounds pretty high, but there are states where anything less than, say, 10% would be cause for celebration. The jobless rate in Michigan is 15%, the worst in the country. Ohio is at 11%. The most employed state, on the other hand, is North Dakota. The labor market there is so healthy, cities and counties are trying to attract laid-off workers from the rest of the Midwest. Dan Bobkoff from WCPN in Cleveland has our story.
Here in Ohio, the recession has only added to the woes of foreclosures and plant closings. It can be a little depressing. So when I called up Shane Gettle, who heads the North Dakota Department of Commerce, it was a bit like stepping into bizarro world.
Overall, our unemployment rate is 4.2 for June. We've had real good strength in energy, agriculture, tourism's actually been good for us.
And then there's this.
We have thousands of jobs available in the state. As of July 1, there were about 9,000 openings.
9,000 jobs.
I know that's that may not be the experience in many other states right now, but it is what is happening in North Dakota.
What is happening is a combination of planning and luck that's left the state with something rare these days, a $700 million budget surplus and a big fat tax cut. Its banks mostly avoided the subprime mess, and North Dakota worked to bring in more businesses like Microsoft. Then prices went up quickly for the state's traditional strengths, energy and agriculture. So now with thousands of jobs available, North Dakota officials have been traveling out of state to try to fill them. Jerry Chavez heads a development corporation for the small city of Minot. Since the beginning of the year, his group has been making monthly visits to job fairs in hard-hit Midwestern communities.
The initial reaction is wow, is there, what are you doing here from North Dakota? You know, you have jobs that are available? Tell us more about these jobs.
Once they get over the surprise that North Dakota is doing well, more out-of-work Midwesterners think seriously about picking up and moving. People like Milton Moore of Cleveland.
For me, the last year or two, it's been terrible. It's been bad. No steady employment, nothing steady.
Moore works in construction when he can get work. But with all his free time lately, he's been playing a lot of Xbox. And it was through a chat room on that video game system that he started talking to a fellow player.
And we were talking about jobs. And he was like, well, you should come to North Dakota. So we had this nice little lengthy conversation on North Dakota, the population, and the whole woo-wop.
Moore was intrigued, so he sent his resume to a bunch of North Dakota employers. He's ready and willing to move when the call comes. Near Columbus, Ohio, Janet Morgan is meeting the movers after she got the call from a call center in Bismarck. She had degrees in useful things like computer science and communications, and yet had no luck finding something in Ohio's job market.
There are just so many people out of work that you can have 500 people, including PhDs, applying for a janitor's position, and they're going to take whoever.
Okay.
So she packed up her stuff and is heading out. Morgan hopes to be promoted quickly at her new call center job. And while she would have rather stayed in Ohio, she likes her new home.
Oh, Bismarck is beautiful. It's clean, and there's a mall, and it's a nice mall, and it has some of my favorite stores.
But it's warm now. What about the frigid winter? North Dakota's Shane Gettle says it's not so bad, and these days they're even taking advantage of their weather.
If you like wind, we have a lot of it, but that's been a real potential for our development as well. So that's why we're putting wind machines out on the prairie.
Rub it in, why don't you? In Cleveland, I'm Dan Bobkoff from Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing absolute return funds for all kinds of investors. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today, one that will make parents everywhere breathe a huge sigh of relief, I'm sure. According to the College Board, most students get out of college with a debt load that is bearable. Of course, that does translate into a median debt of almost $20,000 at the age of 20 or 21. A third of all new bachelor's degree holders have no debt at all. I did a very quick search of the report for how much parents went into debt. Came up empty on that one. Sorry about that. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Tuesday afternoon. Today, the Dow dropped 96 points, 1%. The NASDAQ slipped 22 points, 1.1%. The S&P 500 fell 12 points. That's 1.25%. Thanks to Jennifer Collins and Renita Jablonski on our morning report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abeed. Coming up next time on this program, companies are cutting back, we all know, but boy, their wellness programs, they are alive and kicking.
With layoffs, reductions in force, and so forth, they need to keep their employees healthy, motivated, focused, and productive.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.